You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Peace up, A-Town down. Yeah, yeah.
Usher. Usher. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's go.
In the club with my homies, trying to get a little VI. Keep it down on the low key.
One of the interesting experiences you have as a parent as you get older is you're out someplace, right, at some family event, and music comes on, and your kids, you know, a portion of being inebriated, start dancing. You're like, what is it? What is that?
Come get me, come get me. I got up and followed her to the floor. She said, baby, let's go.
Joining me is, late, I might add, is, you wonder why they're enlisted? They're enlisted for a reason, okay? Joining me is Mike Wilson. Mike, what's up? Oh, he hung up. Don't go away mad. Oh, my God. Hello, Mike, you there? What's going on?
Mike, hello?
Yeah.
Hey, how are you, buddy?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
All right. As I told everybody listening, they're enlisted for a reason, okay? They require supervision. What the hell, man? What's going on? Nothing. We got screwed up, but you're here.
Yeah, I'm here. I'm sorry. I got pulled into some things going on with some patients and some caregivers, so, but I'm here.
All right. First of all, Mike is with the Yellow Ribbon Fund. You can find them, yellowribbonfund.org, and we're going to learn about him real quick and talk about what they do. First of all, Mike, we got to learn about you. We've been talking about haircuts a little bit. A buddy of mine, still on active duty, had a barber. They're a little bit more aggressive than he wanted.
Yeah, I'm familiar.
Exactly, right? And then you all of a sudden you have
are
to...
Are we talking horseshoe?
We're talking, you know, pretty close to not the full horseshoe with the strip on top, but we're talking like encroach the sides and the back to the crown of the head to the point where his kids, when he came in the door, looked at him and said, whoa, get some.
Have you ever heard the term ham slice? You know, it just looks like a ham slice on top of your head. That's what I'm picturing.
It's a little bit more than that, but tell me, those are some fun days, yes? As everybody walks around the corner and goes, whoa, motivator, what's up?
Yeah, so they actually used to call me H.M. Wilson because I used to have the lowest rec possible, and they would call me Doc sometimes because it was so bad.
But see, and they're the best guys. When their hair gets screwed up, that's the best. When somebody goes
really noticeable.
Yeah, exactly. When somebody goes gangster on them and then they've got to walk around with it and just get abused all day, it is absolutely hilarious. The little things in life that we all experience that are just absolutely the best. All right, first of all, Mike, born and raised where?
Annapolis, Maryland.
Oh, you're a Naval Academy guy, but they wouldn't let you in? You didn't want to go there? What's up with that?
Actually, growing up there, no offense to any of the folks that went to the academy, it just wasn't for me.
I'm with it.
You know, my parents are firefighters, and, you know, once 9/11 hit, I enlisted a week later. There was no, Naval Academy was not in the plan at that point.
All right, so why the Marine Corps?
I mean, come on, right? Like, there wasn't another choice, I mean, honestly.
I know, but how do you know that? Yeah, I know that. You know that now. But how did you know that? How did you know that then?
Well, I mean, honestly, like, I did grow up going to, you know, Navy football games, lacrosse, all that good stuff. And, you know, so I was exposed, to that. And, you know, just from a young age, you know, the Marine Corps is the best. So honestly, when it happened, and when I made the decision, there was no other option on the table. I just went right in, and saw the Marine recruiter.
So you had been exposed to the few, the proud at events, and you had seen us in action.
Yeah, you know, from that point when I was a kid, you know, I had a poster and everything. You know, my dad got me with
which poster?
You know, the man. You know,
come
that
on.
Was, well,
you know,
it was like early '90s.
Okay.
So I just remember it being like one of the, you know, the guy with the cami face. You know, like in the boonie, but like the old woodland camis,
right.
You know, coming out of the water.
Motivator.
You know, and that was just, it just kind of stuck in my mind. And, you know, there was no other, I literally didn't even think about it.
Nice. All right. No, I was the same way. I had been exposed to him, and I grew up in California. My dad went to work for the San Diego Padres, and so I wound up in San Diego. And I wanted to be a baseball player, but so on Sundays, when I was in high school, you know, come on, I mean, if you can pull that off, come on, that's like you get all the if you get all the chicks, you win if you're an athlete. So anyway, I think that's the way to go.
Yeah.
But I'd always been had this thing about military history and reading about it and all the rest of that kind of stuff. So I'm in high school, and I'd sit in the bullpen at Jack Murphy Stadium in San Diego, and I'd warm up the left fielder, Dave Winfield or whoever was playing left field for the Padres. So then on Sunday, though, the Marines from the recruit depot come, and the sailors come from when they used to have the Naval Training Center out there. And the sailors would be up there just having a good time. Marines are sitting there, right, you know, hands on your knees, at the position of attention, you know, getting up, asking to go to the head, you know, coming back, drill instructor standing out there with their campaign covers on, looking like badasses. It was like total advertisement for the Marine Corps. And then you'd look and you'd see the Navy guys, and there'd be, you know, people come over to take pictures with them. There was none of that with the Marines. Marines just sat there watching TV. And then for the seventh inning stretch, or I think between one of the innings they played, right, they played the Navy hymn, so they play Anchors Away, and, the Naval recruits, the sailors, wannabes, whatever those guys are, they'd stand up, but when they play the Marines hymn, those guys would come to the position of attention, and at the end of it, they'd be like, "Rah!" And I remember sitting there going, "Look at those guys, man! Those guys are tough." And so
and being attracted to that makes us a little weird, just inherently.
It does. It does. No, I mean,
to look at that and be like, "Yeah, that looks awesome." Yeah. You know that.
Yeah, I'd rather be with those guys than with those guys. Like, those guys are having a good time. Those guys are miserable. I want to be with the miserable guys. You're right. That makes sense. But that's, I didn't look at any, I didn't go shopping or anything like that. Like, I wanted to be a Marine. So, anyway, the propaganda, all brainwashed by it. So you come in and, what year did you come in? Right? 2011 or 2001, right?
So I was in the depth for a couple of months. I guess they were having like an influx of volunteers at that point. So I actually had to wait a couple months. So I went, to Paris Island January 2nd of 2002.
All right. And, so you graduate there. What MOS do you get out of boot camp?
Straight Pogue, admin. It was actually a blessing in disguise because I ended up, working at Walter Reed Hospital, and being a disability counselor and, you know, really digging in to help guys that were doing the work, and helping them, you know, get through the process.
So you started doing after MOS. So in 2001 or 2002, probably when you go to work actually in the Marine Corps, you're, News report. Listen to
yes.
this. Listen to this bullshit. A Virginia Tech freshman arrested for having an assault rifle and trying to purchase 5,000 rounds of ammunition. Are you kidding me?
Smart.
Yeah. Are we going to fucking do this again? So let me tell you. So whoever reported that, good on you. News headline, breaking news right now. So you see it from the start. How do you deploy then?
So what happened is, I moved from headquarters Marine Corps over to Walter Reed Hospital, which was, I was actually attached to the Army Hospital, and I ended up being a platoon sergeant for all of the amputees. I kind of moved around the D.C. area. I worked on the Commandant staff for a little bit, headquarters Marine Corps, the disability section, but, over to the Navy Annex and kind of moved around and then settled at Walter Reed Hospital. The end of 2005, 2006 and 2007. And then, that was like the height of Ramadi and Fallujah and on all of, those just prolific, fights. And I was responsible for all the amputees, that, sacrificed during that time.
So you're pretty much watching all this and your inner Marine God is saying, Wilson, you got to get your ass over
yeah,
this
like,
stuff.
Like, bro, like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And honestly, like, no bullshit. Like, it was one of those things where, the guys that I was helping, were coming straight from the battlefield and, they actually really embraced me, as part of the culture, of recovery, which was actually motivating because I was like, I've never deployed, how do I get in the fight? And I had met some folks and kind of networked, as a young sergeant, and I reached out to a colonel that I had met and be like, hey, sir, like, I really got to get over, like, what can I do? And then he threw me on a MIT team. That started the, chasing the dragon, so to speak.
Okay. So you're on a MIT team. What was your job and where'd you go and when'd you go there?
So I ended up, right, the turn of 2007, 2008, the turn of the year, I went out to Pendleton as part of advisor training group, started at Workbook. They assigned me as like the intel lead. I went through a bunch of schools and then ended up being the security team leader. And then, got a ton of great training.
Yeah.
Which I needed, at that point. And, it actually really prepared us for what we were going to do. And we were embedded with Iraqi security forces in 2008 and, running around the border of Syria and Jordan. We did a lot of, IED interdiction work actually worked with a lot of refugee camps, doing some, like, MedCap stuff, working with some really cool agencies.
Explain MedCap real quick.
So medical capabilities, it's like one of those things that a lot of folks out there, I'm sure, have been a part of. It's a, like a third order effect type of
but it's really,
tactic.
But it's really cool, though. I remember doing them in 2006, I was in Fallujah, and we did one in a place called Karma. I think you've been there. And,
right, yeah.
And we got, I want to say it was every female doctor in the AO, and I mean Army, Air Force, they came from Balad, they came from Camp Victory, came from Kuwait, along with female nurses, and we set up this thing in Karma, and then you're scared shitless, right, that you're going to get a suicide bomber or something in there, and so you have all the security, and they go rolling up there, and then they came back, and I saw one of the sergeants that was in charge of, that was in charge of his section in security, and I said, how'd it go? He said, sir, it was one of the most motivating things I've ever done. I said, what? And he said, it was incredible. He said, you know, a lot of these women have never been seen by a doctor in their lives. You know, they've had multiple children. Some of their children have things wrong with them, and they've never been seen by a doctor. And to be seen by female doctors, you know, I'd never seen that many women crying in one place in my life. And they were just crying for joy. And a lot of, like, the basic things that were wrong with kids that were chronic, they can fix with, you know, just basic medicine. And he said it was awesome. It was awesome. So that's what MedCap, very cool thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Ours were, I'm sure, significantly smaller. And honestly, like, it was to do good work for good, for people who needed it. But also it's a capabilities exercise, right? Like,
right.
You know, who am I, you know, not to use a cliche term, but, like, who am I gaining trust and confidence with to
find out
what's going on?
Hearts and minds, right?
Yeah, I mean, so that, I'll explain why I don't like that term. And
you can't, look, I don't care if you like it, but the bottom line is, that's what we're trying to do, and what we're trying to do is win them over so that maybe they'll tell us next time somebody bad shows up. And so, again, why don't you like the term?
Well, I mean, so after the MIT experience, I didn't really get the fulfillment or test myself. That's not disingenuous. I didn't get the experience that I wanted, but I definitely got in Afghanistan. So as soon as I got back, I started working up. I was attached to a Force Civil Affairs group out of Bowling Air Force Base. And then, you know, we did our workups, went out to the lovely Pickle Meadow. If
nice.
You're familiar.
Yeah.
Did some cool stuff. I went through a lot of classes. I went through a lot of information operations stuff, collections, techniques, etc. And, you know, really got into it once we got to Afghanistan. I was attached to 3-4 out in Farah, 2009, and then attached to 3-6 through the Marja push, the initial Marja push. And,
right.
And, you know, I definitely got, you know, my fill of what I was looking for during that deployment. And, you know, it was, I don't like the term hearts and minds because it really is tactical. And I feel like people throw that term around a lot. It's like, oh, the civil affairs guy's here. Like, you know, we're going to hand out some soccer balls today. It's like, well, actually, buddy, I got 70 grand in a backpack, and I'm trying to meet with
this
warlord.
Do you think it's a condescending term relative to...
Absolutely. Yeah, of course it is.
Get over it, man. It's not. Well, I guess with other Lance Corporals it might be. Yeah, I'm civil affairs.
Well, I mean, I just think it's evolved. I just think the technique and the definition, you know, has evolved. And, you know, my mind has gone back and forth about counterinsurgency over the years and, you know, whether it was the right thing to do and et cetera. But, you know, at the end of the day, that was the task, and that's what we were trying to accomplish.
Right.
And, you know, when I was attached to 3-6, it was one of the greatest experiences I've ever had.
And that was the initial push through Marja?
Yeah. And I'm friends for life with a lot of those guys. And it was just, you know, it filled that void, but also it had a lasting effect on me. You know, mentally, emotionally, physically, I got hit, in Northern Marja, March 10th. And, you know what I mean? It was
March 10th of 2010, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you were there probably.
So
we didn't get there till September. So you were gone before we got there. And then what happened? Did you get blown up? You get shot? What happened?
Yeah, we got blown up leaving a chelator engagement of a dude I, you know, thought went really well. And, you know, as things go, you know, 70 pounds of HME. And then, you know, luckily the other 70 pounds that was daisy chained didn't go off. You know, and also we probably be having a different discussion, but, or not having a discussion at all.
At all, yeah, I was going to say.
So, it left some physical things. I mean, I had a stutter for a year and a half from the, you know, swelling, mild TBI, you know, but having worked at the hospital, you know, and having a lot of buddies that were significantly, sacrificed more, you know, I saw it as like, you know, I was very lucky and it was one of those things that was, I'll get through this because I know so many guys that have, you know, are doing great things after, you know, receiving significantly more trauma. And, you know, I got back after that deployment and, you know, I was a little bitter about a lot of things that happened. Some senior leadership made some, you know, got some guys hurt and, they didn't get people hurt. The Taliban were hurting people, but, right. You know, it's just one of those things. I was a little bitter and, it was, a transition period that was difficult to say the least. A lot of medication, right. A lot of self-medication, and then, you know, trying to find my sense of purpose.
Okay, so you're going through that, which is a pretty popular, I won't say popular, it's a pretty well-worn path that is, you know, trying to, you've watched these guys do it. Now you're one of those guys recovering from mild TBI. And
yeah, it's pretty ironic, right? Like,
yeah. What's next for me? Now, are you medically retired from the Marine Corps, or did you get out?
No, I tried to get out as soon as possible. You know, and that's actually a big regret of mine that I didn't actually follow through with the med board process. And I was just like, look, like, get me out of here as soon as possible. And you know, and I kind of wiggled my way through things. And probably wish I shouldn't have. I should have gotten some things addressed, you know, before
you got out.
I got out, but like I said, man, I was a little bitter. I was angry, and I was on a lot of medication.
What were you angry about most?
I don't want to say I was angry at the world, but I kind of was. Like, you know, I felt like when I came home, and going out. You know, I had a stutter, so I was, like, super insecure. And, like, just, I felt like nobody really gave a shit about, you know, what was going on. Like, the guys that were getting hurt and, not really about myself, but just the what everybody was doing at that time, you know, and the op tempo, the way it was, you know, you come home and you go to a bar and everybody's watching, you know, TV or you hear about the latest, like, reality TV show that people are talking about, you're just like, man, like, just, people don't have a clue, and they don't care. So it was that, I felt disconnected from my family, my buddies, like my, you know, kids I grew up with, like I couldn't just, like, connect with folks the way I did before. And you know, this is a similar story that a lot of guys have.
Let me tell you, you know, you hear the same story from any group of veterans, that how disconnected they felt when they came home. I mean, Vietnam veterans, even more so, right? Because they not only nobody wanted to talk to them, I mean, people didn't like them.
Right.
And so to go, so you, the story you tell is a familiar tale. And so you remedy that by doing what?
Well, I mean, I didn't remedy it initially. I kind of ran away from everything. You know, I did the therapy stuff and finally got to the point where my speech was better. And then it got, you know, better and better as it went on. You know, the migraines and everything were a thing for a while. So the medication was still there. And I, you know, the sleep thing, I was on Lunesta and Ambien.
Nice.
As well as, like, you know, some of the Elevil and all of those things with the, you know, people like brain swelling and stuff. But I kind of pushed myself away from like my support network and then, you know, things kind of hit a tipping point that I had to go home. And then to remedy all that stuff, I didn't really address it head on. I started defense contracting.
And then where did they send you? Which is a refuge?
Well,
which is a refuge for other people in Mike's same situation? Defense contracting, which is go get more of that fix, right? Get away from this. Get me back to what I believe is now normal for me, and that's where I feel most comfortable. So that's where I want to go. Yes.
Right, and you know, so I started working with a firm and ended up back in Afghanistan, but I was in Kabul, which was for me too. I like wanted to prove, I guess, to myself that I could get back in it and go back to Afghanistan. You know, I know a lot of guys like would never want to go back. You know, but for me, it was like one of those things. Like, you know, I want to go back and prove that I can still get after it a little bit. And you know, it wasn't much of getting after it, to be honest. It was, you know, working for an agency. I was working for, you know, the State Department. Well, not an agency, but you know, and then. That wasn't what I thought it was going to be, and then I attached to DOD, and I was back in Iraq and running around northern Iraq through Kirkuk and Kurdistan and all of those good places doing PSD work. And then, you know, that contract was canceled, and then I picked up with Northrop Grumman, and because of my MID experience, they brought me on as a trainer for you know, African soldiers that were fighting in Somalia and Mali and all of those good places. And so I spent like 3 years in Africa training guys, which was awesome.
All right. So but explain, at what point do you say, I've got to find something? And then how does that get you to the Yellow Ribbon Fund?
So I'm a little long-winded.
No, that's all right. That's what I'm here for. I'm the moderator, okay? So that's my job.
In between all that running around, you know, I did think school was very important. And, you know, I felt like if at some point I am going to be successful that I need to finish my degree. So I applied to Georgetown and I was accepted, and then you know, I ended up doing a stress test, to be honest, going back to Iraq for one of the PSD contracts, and then they found out I had heart issues. You know, which may or may not be attributed to what happened, but yeah. So I would go into, my heart would go into tachycardia, if you are familiar. It's where it speeds up without, you know, just starts fluttering, if you will. And you know, they're like, I was canked from the program immediately. So I, you know, I was like, man, I gotta go to school. So finished up school. And then I was working for a firm, doing some lobbying stuff, and then back in Afghanistan for a humanitarian aid organization, still trying to find that sense of purpose. That was super shady, and, you know, living in man jams in the middle of Kandahar, and like, you know, that's not for me. And ended up back in the States, trying to find that sense of purpose, and I found it, you know, helping out the community that I was once a part of, and that's how I landed at the Yellow Ribbon Fund, and which has really, you know, motivated me to give back to the men and women and the community that I was a part of for almost 9 years.
The all right, so tell us about Yellow Ribbon Fund. What is the mission of Yellow Ribbon Fund?
You know, I don't want to give like the cookie cutter, you know, really the mission is to make, you know, the families of wounded, ill, and injured stronger. That's the goal. And we do that through a couple mechanisms. We do it through our housing and transportation program, and we do it through our caregiver support program. The housing and transportation program is affectionately called the Crossroads Program. You know, it's, you know, if you ever been to Quantico, it's the Crossroads of the Marine Corps, and I kind of stole that to, you know, when you get to Walter Reed, and, you know, you really are at a crossroads. You're facing a lot of different things being thrown at you at one time, and navigating your injuries as well as, you know, the next steps in your life. you know, that's kind of how we see that. And then the Keystone Program is the term we created for the Caregiver Initiative, and we see the caregiver as the keystone, you know, keeping the family together. And I think through those two programs, you know, we are able to facilitate stronger families that can successfully transition.
All right, I want to talk about both those, but our time is short here. I've got about 5 more minutes. And then what we'll do is we'll have you back like next Tuesday or something like that, and we'll go cool. into these details. I saw a post that you put up, I think, yesterday on Facebook.
Yeah.
Helping somebody move into a house and tell us which program were you working, which program were you working with, and what were you doing?
So that was my interpreter. So what happened was I was with an interpreter was assigned to me when I was in Afghanistan. He was my guy. He went to all my key leader engagements with me and spent a lot of time together, and we got to know each other really well. You know, and we always kept in touch. And when I left, you know, he still stayed on as a Turk for 3 more years, essentially doing combat tour after combat tour, you know, and then going home and being exposed to retribution. And, you know, I worked for 2 years with him going through the State Department process, the special immigrant visa. And we got him and his family resettled in San Antonio after a long process. And yesterday, you know, was the, like, 1-year anniversary of celebrating that and getting him home. So I gave him a little shout on social media. So it was just really one of the greatest things that I could have done for him, and all the effort that he's done for me and so many other guys on the battlefield.
Those guys, and you know what, you would think, one would think that after we went through this in Vietnam, you know, we probably went through it during the Korean War as well, that we would have a better program that says, hey, look, if you work for us as an interpreter, you know, we've done this before. We have a program that will allow you to come to the United States under this kind of visa, yada, yada, yada. You would think that we would have that thing in a can someplace, but we don't. And it's just so frustrating because these guys become part of your family. They risk their lives with you, and they make you so savvy to the culture that is so foreign to you. It's ridiculous. And then, you know, we turn around and leave and leave them to what? Yeah, he worked with them. Yeah. And then to that fade, and it's not right. So that must have felt great. And congratulations. You know, talk to us before I let you go. I want you to talk real quick about the caregiver thing, because, you know, I think it's something that we don't talk about enough. You know, when you get married, most of the time, nobody envisions becoming a caregiver for life. And I don't mean to diminish this when I say it, but helping somebody put on prosthetics, I would say is at the low end of caregiving. You know, a lot of, you know, guys are without certain functions, be they brain, be they physical, forever. And it's not just ambulatory. They're much more substantial, so that it's not possible for your spouse to have a job anymore. And talk about supporting caregivers, Mike. I mean, I'm sure it's been a part of this that relatively new to you. And talk to us about that.
Yeah. So you know, it's really important that particular initiative is near and dear to my heart because of the support system that I had and all of the kind of hell that I put people through. And, you know, because you're going through your own things, so you're kind of in tunnel vision and you don't really understand the impact you're having on others. When they are managing, significant responsibilities, whether it be, their own, you know, bills, finances, children potentially, you know, their own personal health, you know, just taking a step back for themselves when they're really all their effort is into the patient. And it's really hard. And I know, you know, we don't have much time, but I think it's the caregiver, there's been an evolution in the patient population, at least that we're seeing here in Walter Reed, and you know, we're seeing a lot more cancer, which is brings a whole new dynamic to the caregiver responsibilities, because you're not only navigating all of those things, the responsibilities of day-to-day life, and so that person can concentrate on their, you know, treatment. You know, now you have this whole other thing of being thrown into a situation where you're watching someone deteriorating potentially, and then, you know, there's a potential for the worst case scenario that they don't beat it, and then that caregiver is now turning into, you know, an end of life support system, and they need, you know, grief counseling, and they're dealing with things like wills, and you know, for us, you know, we want to provide the highest quality of life that we can through what we offer, to make those folks as comfortable as they can, to provide a peer support network, to, you know, get them some respite so they can be better at what they do, and, you know, get them the training and education skills that they need, and then the follow-on resources, and that is, you know, what we try to do with our different buckets of delivery, and you know, we want to be agile enough to navigate things like cancers and whatever we haven't even seen yet, as well as, you know, the combat injuries. And really, it's something that needs to be emphasized in the news cycle, and it needs to be written about, because, you know, we're seeing a significant increase in the cancer population here, and while the causality is important, I think really trying to get to some policy that tries to mitigate some of this stuff is the most important. You know, why don't we have 6-month screenings after being in theater, you know, 12-month screenings, you know, 18-month, et cetera, to try to get in front of some of the mortality rates.
And this is post-combat related cancer and things you're seeing more and more of.
Absolutely.
Okay, Mike, I will give you a call later on today and we'll set something up, and I want you to walk us down. And then, just so everybody knows, how do they find Yellow Ribbon on either Facebook or on the internet? What did they do?
Yeah, we're on all the social media platforms, you know, yellowribbonfund.org. Find us on Facebook, the Yellow Ribbon Fund. And then, you know, we actually are on Instagram too, which is great. So definitely come see us there. And, yeah, please, everybody out there, don't hesitate to hit me up if you need anything, to support, you know, anybody, you know, that could benefit from our services.
And how can they find you on the website? Do they go to, is there a thing where they can find Snap?
Yeah, you can go right Snap there. And, you know,
Michael Wilson.
Send me an email, mike@yellowroomfund.org, and I will reply.
Nice. We love that. All right, man. I will give you a call.
Don't send me any, don't send me any, like, you know, weird pictures or anything like that.
Yes. You know, that's all you're going to get now.
I know, right?
That's what happens when you give your email out. All right. Anyway.
I know.
Mike, first of all, congratulations to you, for, you know, finding your way to a great spot. And so to close the interview, is Yellow Ribbon the place that you need to be in terms of purpose in your life?
Absolutely. I wouldn't be anywhere else right now. I mean, you know, it's given me the sense of purpose. It's given me the drive, and you know, there's to come to work every day is a pleasure. It's not an inconvenience.
Right. You know, I think that's one of the things that we sometimes don't address enough in transition. When you've lived a purpose-driven life and you're transitioning out of the military, it doesn't make sense to a lot of people to just go work for money. I need to find...
Yeah, because I definitely don't get that.
Yeah. Yeah, but I you know, I could go make money, but I need to find purpose in it, because if I don't find purpose in it, I'm not going to enjoy it. I'm going to hate it. I know me, and it's not going to work for me. So, So that's cool. It's cool. Long road to get there, but it's cool. Anyway. All right, man. I will give you a call later today. We'll have you back next Tuesday, and we'll spend some more time talking about both programs that you have and looking forward to it. Thanks, man.
All right, brother. Thanks for having me on.
There you have it. Michael Wilson from Annapolis, Maryland, right here on All Marine Radio. We're going to take a quick break. Mike Musselman will join us coming up next right here on a Thursday edition. The Yellow Ribbon Fund. All right. YellowRibbonFund.org on the internet. Check them out. You'll find them. And, again, what they're doing for caregivers, and Mike was talking about what the thing that surprised him was the number of, cancer patients that he deals with and the amount of cancer that comes his way, during the course of a day. So, we'll take a quick break. Michael Musselman will join us next here on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.